Gail's going to read the readings this morning, and you will enjoy her immensely. She's got a wonderful presence.
No pressure. Good morning. Pressure enough just to stand next to Mark Bellatini. I bring you greetings from Ann Arbor. Please don't hate me. I've only been there a year and a half. I heard that go blue. And for those of you for whom that sentiment is heresy, I have two words of encouragement for you, Rich Rodriguez. He's still there. So, the first reading I have for you is from John Wesley, an amazing hymn writer, prolific poet, and sermon writer, and were he writing in the 21st century, twittering, tweeting, and social networking, his entire message would be that which has been capsulized in your order of celebration as one of the quotes. Earn all you can. Save all you can. Give all you can. But let's take a moment to enjoy the fact that he was writing in the 19th century and greatly summarized. This is how he put it. The love of money, we know, is the root of all evil, but not the thing itself. The fault does not lie in the money, but in them that use it. It may be used ill, and what may not? But it may likewise be used well. It is full as applicable to the best as to the worst uses. It is of unspeakable service to all civilized nations in all the common affairs of life. Money is a most compendious instrument of transacting all manner of business and doing all manner of good. In the hands of God's children, money is food for the hungry, drink for the thirsty, raiment for the naked. It gives to the traveler and the stranger where to lay his head. By it we may supply the place of a husband to the widow and of a father to the fatherless. We may be a defense for the oppressed, a means of health for the sick, of ease to them that are in pain. It may be as eyes to the blind. It is therefore of the highest concern that all who fear God know how to employ this valuable talent, that they may be instructed how it may answer these glorious ends. And perhaps all the instructions which are necessary for this may be reduced to three plain rules. First of these is give all you can, but this it is certain. We ought not to do, we ought not to gain money at the expense of life, nor at the expense of your health. Having gained all you can by honest wisdom and unwearied diligence, the second rule of Christian prudence is save all you can. Do not throw the precious talent into the sea. Leave that folly to heathen philosophers. Do not throw it away in idle expenses, which is just the same as throwing it into the sea. Expend no part of it merely to gratify the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eye, of the pride of living. But let not any man imagine that he has done anything barely by going thus far, by gaining and saving all we can. All this is nothing. If a man go not forward, if he does not point all this toward a farther end, nor indeed can a man properly be said to save anything if he only lays it up. You may as well throw all your money into the sea as bury it in the earth, and you may as well bury it in the earth as in your chest or in the Bank of England. Not to use is effectually to throw it away. Add then the third rule to the two preceding. First, having gained all you can. Second, saved all you can, then give all you can. I entreat you, act up to the dignity of your calling. No more sloth. Give all ye have, as well as all ye are. John Wesley. He just didn't fool around. The second reading that I offer you bubbled up in my mind quite independently from the hymn that I've asked that we sing during your time of interlude. They came to me separately for different reasons for this work that I offer you this morning, and yet they have a place next to each other in my own history. This reading was the central reading for my service of ordination. Mark's right, this ministry is a second career for me. There are days when I wonder why being a bookkeeper wasn't a good way to serve, but that's another story. When this reading was used, Summer Day by Mary Oliver has a marvelous pair of lines at the end, and I commend them to you. The poem ends with these two lines. Mary Oliver says, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" And during my service of ordination, I remember thinking as the preacher read that line to me, I heard that word wild. It jumped out at me, and I said, she knows. And she did. And that's the extraordinary thing about our faith tradition, is you bring all you have, we get to know you, and you are welcome. Also at that service, we sang hymn 298. And it's, you know, it's in the context of an ordination service, it's all about wake now, my sense of ministry clear. And it's all about the bold and brave things we're going to do once they set us loose, you know. For our purposes today, when we go through the hymn, at the end of the first verse, there's a pair of lines. It says, giving, receiving, as love shows us how. If you would hold that line with you. And for the Mary Oliver, now that I look back on it, it's that word one that just rings out to me. One wild and precious life. And how shall we spend ourselves? I commend to you the poetry of Mary Oliver, The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? I invite you into the hymn to rise as you're able. 298, wake now my senses.
Thank you.
Well, here we are. You all are in your annual budget drive, and I'm here to reflect with you about money and church. And I could tell you I'm the daughter of a CPA and a bookkeeper. I could tell you my earliest memories of church were counting the cash with my mom on Monday mornings and watching my dad go out the door to finance committees endlessly after dinner at night. He chaired the capital fund drive that more than doubled the footprint of the church that I grew up with. I still remember. I could tell you about sitting between my parents every Sunday morning, no matter what. And I could tell you about being a person whose life has been utterly transformed by Unitarian Universalism. Or I could tell you this, a $20 bill and a $1 bill were chatting one day in a bank teller's drawer. "Hey, 20, what you been up to?" asked the $1 bill. "Well, last week it was the gas station, it was a McDonald's, a bookstore. Hey, I even had a part in a gig for an anniversary dinner at a big restaurant." "What about you, one? What you been up to?" "Nothing so glamorous, you know me, same old thing, church, church, church." "20 minutes of silence would work right now." Instead, I offer you a story. At first, I thought the story was a morality tale, but I couldn't reduce the characters to make pure representations of moral principles. There is no pure evil or pure goodness in this story. I've wildly changed the details in ways to protect the source of the story, but I needed also to protect the complexity of the characters. You see, the men in this story are real. This happened. At first, I thought to call the story "The Rich Man and His Son." And then I called it "The Rich Man's Dying Wish." But none of those titles worked completely either, as the story worked on me over time. So I leave it to you to find the title, how you will file it in your hearts. Here's the first part of the story. Long ago, and not very far away at all, a man grew up in extreme poverty. His father died young, succumbing to injuries sustained in the First World War. The man was raised by a single mom who scrubbed toilets in a movie theater as a second job just to keep the rent paid and her two boys fed. The man vowed someday he would make a lot of money and his family would never, ever go hungry. And he worked hard and he made a lot of money. And he bought a home for his mother and he lived well himself. He married and educated three children who never knew hunger. The man and his oldest son did not get along well. There were such deep differences. The man was athletic and he loved to fish. The son, while strong and capable, thought fishing was boring. And he always, always had his nose in a book. The man expected his son to go into the family business and continue to make a lot of money. The son had no interest in that work. He drifted off to college. He studied theoretical things. He learned about the new phenomenon of computers. The son never made much money. The man was furious. He loved his son. He yearned for his son to be successful, but he berated his son over and over for not making money, for not measuring up. I'll come back to the man and his son in just a bit. They've been on my mind so much, you see, because their story is very much about money. I've been thinking about money. I've been thinking about money a lot. In the congregation I serve in Michigan, we have been struggling to fund our aspirations. The Michigan economy is in perilous condition. We listen to CNN say, woo, unemployment down to 9.6. In Michigan, we're happy when it's at 17%. Our folks have been hit hard. The challenges, however, are not wholly unwelcome. It is not a bad thing to revisit how we spend ourselves, how we spend our lives, how we spend our money. While these exercises of fine-tuning our values through trimming and directing our spending have been engaging my time, I found myself humming the phrase from the hymn we just sang, giving, receiving, as love shows us how. Love teaches us. Love shows us how to live more fully. Another of the lessons to be found in love was sketched out in the hymn we visited earlier. Make channels for the streams of love. We need to be intentional about the structures that we build to convey love, channel love, shape love. Giving to others is the main structure we build. We secure the gifts of love for ourselves, and we strengthen the gifts of love for others through the channels that we build in our hearts, in our homes, in our kinship circles. And the church, the religious community, on our good days, the beloved community, is the biggest channel, the biggest structure most of us will ever be a part of that will give strength to our aspirations to provide love for others. We give money to the beloved community to touch the lives of others, to touch the lives of those known to us and unknown to us. We give money to the church so we can make a difference in the world. We give money to the church so we can widen our reach, to assist ourselves and others to live lives of meaning and purpose, to make real our values, to inspire others, to challenge others, to comfort others, and to build something that extends out beyond the finite bounds of our own self-interests. Throughout all this thinking and wrestling and reflecting about giving and building, I kept hearing that line, giving and receiving as love shows us how, which is where we pick up again with the story of the rich man and his much berated son. The man would just not let up. He scolded his son for not making enough money. He scolded the son for not doing enough for his family, although actually by the time I knew them well, the son had sons of his own, and those fellows were well on their way to turning out all right. I sometimes wondered if the rich man were scolding his son for reasons that were clear only to his own memories and his own demons, but that's not directly a part of the story. One day, the rich man came home from a doctor's appointment with a shocking diagnosis. He would die. See, he hadn't planned on dying. Well, at least anytime soon. But die he would, his doctor said, and shockingly soon. The rich man came home and sequestered himself with his wife of 50-plus years, and they made their peace in the same forthright way they had made their plans over all those years. And then the children were gathered, spouses and grandkids and all, and I was there too to bear witness. Life would go on as usual, the rich man proclaimed. We want for nothing. I will live until I die, that is that. Or so it was for a short while. You know, this business of not needing anything, this worried me. I couldn't see how it was sustainable, and I couldn't see how it ought to be sustainable. Now I can see more of why that line from the hymn was circling in my head, giving, receiving, as love shows us how. That was one of the gifts that the rich man had for me. Over the coming weeks, he would teach me about receiving. It's a hard thing sometimes to be the receiver. Our culture glorifies the distorted kind of individualism that devalues what we can learn from or benefit from by way of others. The rich man, as though it were a good thing, was often described as a self-made man. He had worked hard to accumulate enough money that he could be self-contained, and he was going to maintain that to his end. Again, implicitly, he was berating now all of his children. There is nothing you can do for me. And it made me wonder how I am learning to receive the love and the comfort of others. The rich man had learned that to be in need, to receive from others, was a sign of weakness. He had learned that to admit need was a kind of failure. Do you harbor that notion in your own lives? He knew that to receive from others, we each need to relinquish our illusions of having full control over our lives. Even after his doctor told him he was dying, the rich man went right on blustering about as though he had control over his life. Or so he did for several weeks. You know, when we talk about money in church, we are in a conversation that goes deeper and wider than just the cold transactional exchange of cash for services. Giving money to a church is not like any other kind of exchange of giving money. When we understand what is at stake, we do not give in a balanced exchange for what we take away. Few of us ever have that kind of money to offer, and most of us misread that terribly. Money in religious community is a symbol, it's a metaphorical gesture at best. Our offerings of money can move beyond being part of a transaction and bring us into transformational relationship with the deepest experiences imaginable of meaning, of purpose, and powerful change. How could we possibly give enough in exchange for that? Most of us give too little to our churches because we've been taught wrong-headed things about churches and money. First, you know, we're so often told that we should give generously, wait for it, because the church needs our money. Besides being about as attractive as watching paint dry, it's just not broadly true. It's quite myopic, actually. Excuse me. Yes, the church needs money, but truly, your money needs the church much, much more than this church needs your money. To get the fullest possible value out of your hard-earned money, to realize the broadest and the deepest transformational rewards in your own life, your money needs this religious community. Here, your financial generosity can be transformative and salvific for you, for others, well out beyond the reach of your limited vision and zones of comfort. We don't give money to church in a transaction of exchange. We give money to church to transform our own lives, to assist in offering the chance for transformation to others, and to express gratitude. Again, another wildly wrong thing we hear. One of my favorites, as the daughter of a church treasurer, a man who loved life, we're supposed to give until it hurts. Give money to the church until our own level of giving is painful, is hurtful to us. First of all, that's just twisted. You don't work with it, that's twisted, right? And second of all, church life should never be without some level of discomfort. Otherwise, you're not being challenged enough. But giving until it hurts is unhealthy, and it's wrong on so many levels, and it sets the giving levels way, way too low for our own well-being. It hurts our spirits to be cheap. It hurts our spirits to be so unconnected, so aloof, so untrusting. You know, most of us yearn to make a difference in the world. The more we give, the bigger the difference we can make. We have the opportunity not just to give so little that it hurts. We can give so that we begin to feel good. And we can give more until we are in the middle of feeling really, really good about our commitment, about our connection, about our agency in being part of a transformative presence. We can give until we are utterly certain that we belong here, that we are part of something larger than our own self-interests. Not long after the rich man came back from his doctor's office with the news he was going to die soon, I was visiting with him alone. The man told me he could no longer get up out of bed by himself. He had needed to be partly lifted by his wife, and he had trouble getting himself to the bathroom. And what could he do? We talked about the injections his wife was giving him, the meals she was cooking, and now the lifting, the tending. It was clearly too much for her. I was newly minted in ministry at the time and eager to be helpful. And I chirpily prattled off a series of really cool options. The man's insurance could pay for home health aides. Nurses could be hired, or he could move to the beautiful hospice that had just opened in the next town. The man, wiser than I in the moment, said he needed some time to think, and could I come back in a few days when his son and his daughters would be there with him. And when I returned, I heard a story that I filed in my heart with the title, The Rich Man's Dilemma. We gathered all around the rich man to hear what he had gathered us to hear. What I most want, the rich man confessed, is to die at home. I want to stay at home, and I do not want a parade of strangers coming in and out of our home. There was a hard silence as weariness filled the eyes of his beloved wife. The children shifted in their seats. No one in that room wanted to disappoint this man. He was truly a loving and a generous man. And yes, he was harsh to his firstborn. He was demanding in every possible way. But here was a man who had worked terribly hard his whole life, a man who had generously provided for family and church and community. And what could be done now? The man's eldest son was rarely the first to speak. His technique for keeping the peace was to wait and to hold back. Let me see if I get this right. The son surprised us all by asking, you want to stay at home, but you want no strangers coming in and out. Yes, said the man, his eyes beginning to close with the weight of it all. And the son regarded his father in silence for an extended time. And finally, the son spoke. Dad, I will stay with you. I will have my office stuff shipped here from home. I will be here. Now, this was in the days way before laptops and wireless internet. Two big desktop computers and monitors and a printer had to be shipped in enormous boxes. This is my favorite part of the story. Two telephone lines, remember that? Two telephone lines had to be installed to provide internet access and business telephone. They couldn't be on the same line. Everybody got busy to make the plan work. The son set up his business in his father's living room. And whatever the father needed, day or night, the son was there. The son was a comforting presence for his mother, and he was a personal care assistant for his father through the weeks to the morning of his death. The rich man's dying wish was to die at home without the care of strangers. It was a wish that neither money nor insurance could buy. As I visited the two men in those last weeks, I saw a tenderness that went deeper than words. I saw the berating and the harshness fade into the past. I saw forgiveness and acceptance growing in their eyes. The son, who was such a failure at making money, had provided the demanding father the dying wish that money could not buy. I saw tenderness. I saw love. I saw the father realize that although he had not taught his son to make a lot of money, he had been successful in teaching his son to give of himself. And the son, in turn, had taught his father to receive. Every morning, we have a chance to ask ourselves, what shall I do with my one wild and precious life? Every day we decide, every moment we decide, with every breath we decide.